It is Friday, February 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump defends his administration at a White House news conference. Islamic State claims a suicide bombing at a shrine in Pakistan. And two Oscar-nominated documentaries show the refugee crisis. It's all ahead. President Donald Trump used his first solo press conference in the White House to deliver a broad defense of his turbulent first month in office. He denied reports of chaos within the White House and insisted his administration is running like a fine-tuned machine. I spoke with Norman Ornstein, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, and asked whether yesterday's news conference was unique in White House history.
We have never seen anything like President Trump's press conference. Normally, when presidents do press conferences, they're fairly controlled and they last for 30 or 40 minutes. This one pushed up to an hour and a half. It was stream of consciousness. It was berating reporters and talking about false news. It was giving his own versions of false news. It was extraordinary and unsettling.
You know, Mr. Trump has a background in television, particularly reality television. Perhaps he kind of thought, in a way, this he was trying to give a performance.
I think he clearly was a combination of angry at how he'd been treated, angry at what had happened with National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, which I should say, just as an aside, was one of the more bizarre moments. He talked about what a fine person Michael Flynn was and how badly he'd been treated by the press and the intelligence community. But, of course, he was the one who fired Flynn, and it was almost like what he was saying was, when I find the dirty guy who fired him, I'm going to take care of him. It was you, Mr. President. But at the same time, this was sort of Trump in campaign mode, which is clearly the happiest Trump. And he segued from that to going down to do another campaign rally in Florida. He doesn't like what it means to be president to actually govern. He's comfortable campaigning, even if it's in a combative mode with journalists, with others he can treat as foils. And I expect we're going to be seeing more press conferences of this sort. But for the people who are his core supporters, and they're still very much with him, they just see him taking on the people that they hate.
Yeah, I was just going to say that because this certainly probably will appeal to his base.
You know, one thing that's important to realize here is, and we see this with now the newest survey by the Pew Research Center, Trump's approval is now down at 39% in that survey, and we've never seen anything like this for a new president. Every other new president since we've been recording public opinion has been well over 50%, sometimes up to 70 or 80 3 weeks or 4 weeks in. But what we also see is a stark difference. 90% or more of Democrats strongly disapprove of Mr. Trump. 88% or so of Republicans approve, most of them strongly. The independents who disapprove are the ones who make the difference that brings him down to such a low level. But as long as he can keep that core of people approving of him, he will also keep most of the Republicans in Congress because these are their voters. These are the ones who will turn out in the primaries, and they're going to grow increasingly uneasy as well. It was striking that many Republicans anonymously talked to reporters after Republicans in Congress after the press conference, basically saying how distressed they were at, as one put it, this maniac. They're just trying to get by, but they know if they take him on directly, they're taking on their own voters.
That's Norman Ornstein, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank. Joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, we have two dueling hashtags on social media about what else? facts and fake news. So we'll start with hashtag Day of Facts. And this is a hashtag that's being used by museums, libraries, other cultural and scientific institutions to talk about different facts, whether they be about the environment, history, biology, you name it. So you're seeing a lot of institutions using this day to put up facts about things like climate change or evolution. In fact, the Field Museum in Chicago, which is one of the world's most esteemed natural history museums, is doing a series of short videos where they're having their scientists and curators hold up signs with different facts about the natural sciences. And this has now developed as it's gone on into other people sharing facts about immigration, about refugees, and even things like healthcare and education. So it's just been a way for people to kind of coalesce and put out these different facts. Now, the other hashtag on the other side of this is hashtag Media Lies Again. This is something that's developed out of President Trump's press conference yesterday, where he said at a number of points that there was fake news and the media was lying. So you have a lot of people trying to cite examples of inaccurate reporting that paints President Trump in a bad light, different headlines that they feel are biased, published over different time periods, even claims of bias against First Lady Melania Trump, as she's received some criticism for the amount of money that's being spent in New York to secure her. So you see these two kind of hashtags going back and forth, a little bit of intermixing between the two as people face off with each other on social media. But since today is Friday, it's the end of the week, I will end with a nice hashtag today, hashtag Random Acts of Kindness Day. A lot of people highlighting just little things, even people holding the door open for them, just saying thank you, little things that are making people's day better. So perhaps that's something we can all learn from, that hashtag Random Acts of Kindness Day, and make everybody's day a little bit brighter.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really great.
Yeah.
It's a great way to look forward to the weekend.
Absolutely.
Thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor, Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. An Islamic State attack leaves 17 Afghan soldiers dead. Researchers argue for an eighth continent, which could be called Zealandia. South Africa's land redistribution debate gains momentum, and Russia is cautious on the resignation of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and dismisses the Trump administration's tougher line on Ukraine. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The Indian Space Research Organization set a record with the recent launch of 104 satellites on one rocket. The 39th flight of its Polar Satellite Launch Vehicle took off from its Satish Dhawan Space Center on an island located off the coast of the Bay of Bengal. The launch vehicle carried not only the space agency's Earth-observing CartoSat 2D satellite, but also a fleet of 103 tiny satellites, too. While two of the miniature spacecraft, also called nanosatellites and CubeSats, were from India, 96 of the remaining units came from the United States, with the Netherlands, Switzerland, Israel, Kazakhstan, and the United Arab Emirates each sending up one. The mass of the CubeSats ranges between 1 kilogram to a little over 4.5 kilograms. Most of the mini satellites sent into space aboard the Indian rocket will be used to capture images of Earth. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, President Trump visits a Boeing aircraft factory in South Carolina. An Islamic State suicide bomber killed at least 88 people and wounded about 250 others Thursday inside a crowded Shiite shrine in southern Pakistan. A wave of suicide bombings and other militant attacks have killed and wounded dozens of people this week across that country. A military spokesman said recent terrorist attacks in Pakistan are being executed on directions from hostile powers and from sanctuaries in Afghanistan. I spoke with reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad about the security crackdown in Pakistan following the attack at the shrine.
Immediately after this bombing, authorities basically revealed that they had the information about this attack, and that is why they were able to go after the suspected handlers or plotters of this attack. And since Thursday night, this crackdown has been in place, and so far, of officially, it has been confirmed that at least or around 50 suspected militants have been killed by security forces in different cities of Pakistan.
What is the significance of the shrine that was attacked? And the shrine, I think, is in southern Pakistan.
Yes, it is in the Sindh province, which is in southern Pakistan. And this is a very famous shrine in Pakistan where every day a big crowd gathers, mostly from Shiite Muslim devotees who just converge on the shrine. And from all over Pakistan, it is so famous. And it was obviously considered, under the current circumstances, by these militants a soft target where so many people usually gather. And on Thursday evenings every week, the crowd is much, much bigger. And that is why this bomber was sent, apparently, to cause maximum damage. And it has obviously now, with the official death toll, is around 90, and more than 200 people were wounded, and according to doctors, even until an hour ago, 40 to 50 people are still in critical condition.
And there were a number of civilian victims, and you know, women and children that were affected by this.
Mostly they were women and children, because it happened inside the compound in an area where this spiritual dance was taking place. When this weekly celebration ends, they all perform this spiritual dance, but mostly it's women and children who were gathered in this particular part of the shrine. And that's why initial information that the police have provided to media suggests that the bomber was, in fact, or could be a female who was wearing this veil or burqa, the traditional clothing that covers a woman from head to toe. And that's why authorities or whoever was there deployed to take care of the security could not detect and let this person, if it was, it's still not clear whether it was a man or woman. It's difficult to determine when the person is wearing this veil. So the person was allowed inside this area where women and children together were dancing, and that's when this bomb strapped to the body of this suspect was detonated.
And I guess this is straining relations with Afghanistan, because there's some believe that these attacks could, or some of the attackers could be coming from that country.
Yes, that's true. And the reason for that is that the American military, the U.S. military, has also confirmed that when the Islamic State launched its regional operations under the name of Islamic State Province of Khorasan, it first established its roots in the eastern Afghan province of Nangarhar, which borders Pakistan, and that's where this group now has bases in several districts. And authorities in Pakistan allege that these fighters are using this long porous border between the two countries to cross into Pakistan and launch these attacks. And that is why the Pakistan military instantly last night came up with this allegation that they were able to determine that the attackers came from Afghanistan. So instantly Pakistan closed its border with Afghanistan, which is quite a significant move because thousands of people move back and forth every day. But Pakistan, since last night, sealed its border with Afghanistan and has this morning, in fact, the Afghan ambassador in Islamabad was summoned to the Pakistan military headquarters and was handed over a list of 76 terrorists, according to the army statement, that Pakistan said are based in Afghanistan. These are anti-Pakistan militants who have taken refuge in border provinces of Afghanistan. And the Afghan ambassador was asked to communicate or to convey to his government to take immediate action and hand these people over to Pakistan.
That's reporter Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad. President Donald Trump is scheduled to visit a Boeing aircraft factory in South Carolina on Friday. The visit occurs just days after workers there rejected a bid to join the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers Union. Trump is scheduled to see the rollout of a new version of a wide-body jetliner, the Boeing 787-10 Dreamliner. Boeing announced Thursday that Singapore Airlines is committed to buying 10 of the huge planes that can seat more than 300 passengers. 3,000 of the workers who build Dreamliners were eligible to join the union, but three-quarters of them voted against the measure after a long and hard-fought campaign that pitted union organizers against the company. Kate Bronfenbrenner is an expert on labor relations from Cornell University.
Unions win and lose all the time. When they lose, it tells us mostly about the quality of the union campaign. My research shows that union victory or loss depends most on union strategy. Employers run very typical campaigns. They run pretty much using the same strategy every time. They run very aggressive, hostile, I would say, campaigns to unions, but almost all employers use the same strategies. The difference is in the quality of the union campaign.
South Carolina has the lowest level of union representation in the nation at 1.6%. State officials say businesses are more likely to bring jobs to an area where companies don't have to cope with unions. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
This is International Edition. Two documentaries on the plight of refugees off the Italian coast and the Greek coast, respectively, have received Oscar nominations this year. Fire at Sea by Gianfranco Rossi has been selected in the feature documentary category, and 4.1 Miles by Daphne Matsuriaki has been nominated in the short documentary category. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with Rossi about his film and about how these documentaries help bring public awareness to the refugee crisis in a tough political climate.
Lampedusa. Over the past 20 years, the tiny Italian island, 120 kilometers off the Sicilian coast and 70 kilometers off the coast of Tunisia, has become a gateway to Europe for close to 500,000 refugees.
Your position, please. Your position.
Please, can you hold up quickly?
How many people?
150 people. We have small children. Please, can you hold up? We are staying here in...
Through his cinematic masterpiece, Oscar-nominated Gianfranco Rossi conveys two different worlds inhabiting the tiny island. The quiet, unassuming islanders and the incoming migrants.
These two communities, the islanders and the migrants, never meet. So Lampedusa became almost like a metaphor of what's happening in the world, you know, these two forces that they barely touch each other and they never meet.
Rossi's documentary introduces a few islanders. Each one reflects the human condition in the middle of a world humanitarian crisis. He centers his film on Samuele, a Sicilian boy living on the island. Rossi likens his exuberance, roughhousing, as well as his tenacity and introspection to a humanity that has not yet reached maturity.
And the anxiety of Samuele is our own anxiety. The wonder of Samuele is our own wandering. The lazy eye of Samuele is our lazy eye.
On the other end of the specter is Dr. Bartolo. As the only physician on the island, he examines every single refugee coming to Lampedusa and confirms the dead. Bartolo is the voice of reason and compassion.
Tutto questo ti lascia tanta rabbia, ti lascia un vuoto nello stomaco, un buco.
The refugee crisis is also at the center of Daphne Matsuiaraki's short documentary, 4.1 Miles. The film, which also received an Oscar nomination, chronicles around-the-clock rescue missions off the Greek island of Lesbos. Coast Guard Kyriakos, the main character in the story, says that he and his team are called to rescue 200 people per hour. According to the film, between 2015 and 2016, 600,000 migrants crossed 6.5 kilometers of water, that is 4.1 miles, between Turkey and Lesbos.
I was proposing Lampedusa and Lesbos for the Nobel Prize, you know, these two special islands in the middle of nowhere that they welcome migrants from all over the world.
Rossi hopes his film helps bring awareness about the refugees' ordeal.
It's like in this moment, you know, when people say, what can I do now? Where do I stand? Which one is my position?
Your position. My friend. Hello. Hello.
Penelope Poulou, VOA News, Washington.
And that is our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States strongly condemns the suicide attack at the Afghan Supreme Court in Kabul February 7th, which killed at least 21 Afghans, including several women working for the court, and wounded more than 40 other people. The Islamic State claimed responsibility for the attack and promised future assaults against Afghanistan's judiciary. White House spokesperson Sean Spicer called the bombing a cowardly act and condemned it in the strongest possible terms. He also praised the Afghan security forces for their rapid response. U.S. Embassy Kabul's chargé d'affaires, Ambassador Hugo Lorenz, said in a statement that the attack was a strike against the very foundation of Afghan democracy and the rule of law by terrorists who have no regard for human life and a flagrant hatred of a democratic system of justice. On February 8th, six members of the International Committee of the Red Cross, the ICRC, were shot and killed in Jowzjan province while they were delivering supplies to areas hit by devastating snowstorms and avalanches. The whereabouts of two other aid workers from the same convoy are unknown. ICRC President Peter Maurer said these staff members were simply doing their duty, selflessly trying to help and support the local community. No group immediately claimed responsibility for the attack on the ICRC staff members. Provincial authorities suspect that Islamic State terrorists who are active in the area were the perpetrators. A recent report by the United Nations Assistant Mission in Afghanistan, or UNAMA, recorded 11,400 civilian casualties last year, 7,920 injuries, and 3,498 deaths caused by the violent conflict in Afghanistan, the majority by anti-government extremists, mainly the Taliban. UNAMA noted that civilian casualties caused by terrorists linked to the Islamic State rose significantly from 82 in 2015 to 899 last year, a tenfold increase. Afghanistan deserves peace and security, said Chargé d'Affaires Ambassador Lorenz. My government and the people of the United States are and will remain committed to standing with the people of Afghanistan and its elected representatives in their fight against terrorism and in working toward a peaceful and prosperous future supported by justice and the rule of law. We stand with the Government of National Unity and people of Afghanistan in bringing an end to these barbarous attacks against its people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.